All right. Welcome, everybody. This is the Didactic Mind Podcast. I am your host, Didact, and welcome to episode 42, Didactic Mind episode 42, Life, the Universe, and Everything. A very warm welcome to all of my listeners. A very warm welcome to all of my SoundCloud subscribers. A very warm welcome to all of my loyal readers from the blog, especially, of course. The blog is, as you probably know, didactsreach.blogspot.com. That is going to change over the coming days and weeks as I finally migrate onto WordPress, hosted WordPress, because, frankly, I'm sick and tired of bloggers. Horrible change to the interface. I never liked it when it was first proposed. I like it even less now. And it is going to become the default before very long. So I'm not at all pleased about that. I'm not happy about the way that they're going about changing things. And I'm rather looking forward to getting off the Blogger platform and onto my own. As always, if you want to support me and what I do, go over to superbshaving.com. And eventually, once I find the time, there will be new websites coming out. There will be Didactic Strength, which will be all about strength training, powerlifting, and general fitness as a way to keep yourself trim, healthy, active, and more or less ready for whatever life throws at you. And there will be a couple of others. I've already got one site planned out for kind of explaining what it's like to live in Moscow, because I've spent a hell of a lot of time there. Not all that pleasant, but on balance, I think that has more to do with the people I was with than the city itself. The city is magnificent and wonderful, and that site will be all about traveling to Eastern Europe, getting to know Eastern European people, customs, culture, and really getting to understand how to succeed in that culture, because I think what we're seeing with the way the world is evolving is that Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations thesis is being proven more true every single day. And I'll get to that maybe in a future podcast, and I've covered it in a considerable degree in other podcasts that I've done before, where I've talked about the interplay between the USA and China. And I hope to get around to the interplay between the Muslim world and basically everyone else in the near future. Well, that's if you think what I do right now is offensive, you're going to find that one really offensive, because I do not pull my punches when it comes to Islam. But the title of today's podcast is a bit whimsical. And the reason for that is because it is indeed episode 42. Now, for those of you who have read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, you will know that Deep Thought, the computer created by the ancient race of hyper-intelligent mice, I think it was, to figure out the answer to the question of what is the meaning of life, the universe, and everything, pondered and pondered and pondered for millions of years, and then came up with the answer 42. That is the answer to life, the universe, and everything. And it seems somehow fitting, given that this is episode 42. Believe it or not, this podcast has been running for that bloody long. And it seemed appropriate to give it that title. But what I'm going to discuss today is anything but whimsical. What I'm going to discuss today is profound. It is important. It is... excuse me. It is the secret to success in any and all endeavors. It is the difference between being happy and self-actualized or self-actuated. I sound like a frickin' McKinsey consultant saying that, but that's the term that you want to use. It basically just means that you are self-contained and capable of taking responsibility for yourself as an adult human being. And you know, it is the difference between being that and being somebody who constantly whines and complains and puts his failures in life and ascribes his misery to malign outside forces. The answer to life, the universe, and everything for us as people, especially for us as men, is really, really simple. It can be summarized in one sentence. And I've used this sentence on the blog before many times, and I hope to use it again many more times in this podcast and in other podcasts. That sentence is, everything in your life that is not exactly the way you want it to be is your fault. It's your fault. You are responsible. Don't go blaming anyone else. Don't go blaming your friend or your boss or your coworker or the guy on the street or your parents or your sisters or your brothers or God, especially not God. Don't go blaming anybody for your own failures. Now, it is true that in a literal sense, this is a huge exaggeration. It is true that, you know, if you were struck by a bullet in a random freakish accident, and that leaves you bound to a wheelchair for life, that's not your fault, obviously. That is not directly your responsibility. It's what happened to you in that case is out of your control. But by adopting that mindset, you automatically adopt the mindset that, okay, I'm not where I want to be. It's in my control to fix it. Now I can go fix it, and I am responsible for the happiness that comes from fixing it. No one else can make me happy. No one else can give me what I want. Only I can take it. Only I can build it. Only I can find it. That is the most important lesson that most men never learn. Well, the second most important lesson, probably. After, you know, you will love God with all... First, you will love God with all your heart. And that's a very, very hard lesson to learn. Trust me, I know. But the point of this saying is that it puts the onus of responsibility squarely upon you to look at your life, evaluate what it is that you don't like about it, and change it, if indeed you're really serious about changing it. It means that you can't dodge or excuse or evade or change the subject anymore. It means you say to yourself in the mirror, and therefore to the rest of the world when you go out and confront it, yeah, I'm not what I want to be. But you know what? That's in my control, because I admitted that it's my fault. So now I can go fix it. Now that I've admitted it's my problem, I can go figure out how to fix it. Nobody else needs to tell me how to solve it. I can go figure it out. And it makes you, the individual, responsible for yourself. And this, to me, is the single greatest key to happiness that I think any man can find within himself. Just within himself. I'm not talking bowing down before God and obeying godly principles. I'm talking about just obeying this, or just having a sense of fulfillment and peace with himself. If you have read Extreme Ownership by Jocko Willink, I haven't, by the way. It's on my very, 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 very long list of books to read, especially nonfiction books. But if you have read that book, you will understand why somebody like Jocko Willink is such a magnetic personality. There's a great video, a tremendous one, from Prager University. Now, I generally regard PragerU as run by a bunch of Pharisaical Neo-Palestinians, which is to say, Jews who, while I like the Jewish race very much, and I like Jews in general very much, I don't like their attempts to spin the truth and change the facts about the origins and growth of Western civilization. I don't like that. I don't like it when people from Prager University, from Prager, you keep constantly conflating Judaism and Christianity. You'll hear it over and over again from Dennis Prager, Ben Shapiro, or, you know, Shapiro, the littlest chicken hawk, as we call him, right on down through the ranks. The argument over at PragerU is that the West was founded on Judeo-Christianity. I don't know what this bullshit is. There's no such thing as Judeo-Christianity. There's Judaism, and there's Christianity. And Christianity is a much older religion, actually, than modern Judaism. Do not mistake my words. Christianity is a heresy of Judaism. That is true. But modern Judaism, modern Talmudic Judaism, is actually a younger religion by about 500 years than Christianity. If you don't believe me, there is a series of articles on my blog about an interaction between me and an Israeli Jew. Really good guy, secular Jew. He goes by the name of the Male Brain, also known as Dawn Pine. And I have done a podcast with him. It's a very good podcast. I highly recommend you listen to it. It's somewhere in my archives, in which you can actually hear the Male Brain talk about some of these issues about Judaism. Judaism, as we understand it today, is not the religion that it was 2,000 years ago. And Judaism, as seen in the Talmud, is largely an attempt to lawyer around the words of the scriptures, by and large. Now, the Male Brain, Dawn Pine, may well disagree with that. In fact, he does disagree with that in some regards. And I respect that. I have great respect for the guy. He's a really cool dude, very accomplished in his field, and just a really genuinely excellent guy with a lot of great ideas that he keeps bringing to me, in fact. But I think what you will find is that Judaism and Christianity are violently opposed to one another, and Jews especially resent attempts by Christians to bring them into the fold, because as far as they're concerned, Christians are heretics. But coming back to PragerU, as much as I dislike their attempts to dissemble and lie about the roots of Western civilization, in this one video, which was a mock commencement speech by Jocko Willink from a few years back, you have to see the video to understand its impact. But basically, Jocko tells you there are no shortcuts, there are no easy fixes, there are only pathways to excellence through discipline and focus and self-responsibility. And you should read the comments section. It's absolutely hysterical, because Jocko has such magnetic, forceful presence in that video, and he brings that to every single thing he does. If you listen to his podcast or you watch his videos, he does that with everything, because he has such an aura of leadership and strength about him. The reason why he has this is because, as he writes in his book, Extreme Ownership, his philosophy of life is that you must take responsibility for everything in your life. And it brings to mind the famous poetry of Tecumseh, the great Indian chieftain, Tecumseh. And assuming the internet connection cooperates, I'll try to find that actual poem. It's beautiful. It's an absolutely wonderful poem, and I'll try to quote from it in a bit. But basically, Tecumseh talks about how it is necessary to beautify your life and complete your life and take responsibility for your life. And he's absolutely right. Now, in Extreme Ownership, Jocko tells a story about a group of SEAL teams in a SEAL battalion. If there are any former SEALs listening, my humble apologies. I am not familiar with the unit structure of your Spec Warcom teams, so you'll have to forgive me if I sound like an idiot. It is genuinely, I mean, I just, I don't know. But basically, the story that he tells is of a series of teams running a series of exercises, this group running a series of exercises. And the team that came first always did one thing. They always came first, and they always did one thing after every single victory, after every single time that they won something. And the team that came last was always the same team, and they always did something made them come last. And it's interesting to figure out what it was. Now, the team that came last would always be punished with extra laps and extra, you know, just stuff to do, just extra exercises. It was never any fun for them. It was miserable. But they spent all that time kind of blamestorming. And blamestorming just means they pointed the fingers at each other. They said, oh, this guy didn't do this right. He didn't set up the obstacle right for the next guy to follow on. The guy who was being blamed, well, he would turn around and point to somebody else and say, oh, well, you know what? He didn't carry his weapons properly. And then that cost us an extra 3 seconds because he was cocking about and messed us up on the obstacle where we could have won. And that guy would turn around and say, well, you know, the platoon leader was... He gave us imprecise instructions, so I don't know what the hell I was supposed to do. And on and on and on it went. The result of all of this blame game nonsense was that the bonds of trust and responsibility were eroded to the point where nobody trusted each other in that team. And therefore, nobody could get anything done. Because nobody was willing to take individual responsibility. The team that won everything was the exact opposite. The team that won everything always won and would get extra time to kind of relax and stretch out while everybody else was getting pounded into the dirt by the instructors because they goofed or something, they hadn't done it right. And they were told, the outside observers who watched this team were like, what's going on with these guys? Why are they so hyper-focused? Why do they act like seamlessly? Why are they so skilled at working together? And when they observed what people were doing, it was very, very obvious. The platoon leader would step up in front of his whole squad or his whole platoon, and he would say, all right, boys, let's analyze what we did wrong. Let's take responsibility for our mistakes. I'll start. And he would say something, I take responsibility for this. I didn't do this right. I'm going to fix it. This is how I'm going to fix it. Then he'd point to the next man and say, okay, what did you do wrong? And that guy would say, sir, I didn't prepare the rope correctly for the next man in the line. It wasn't a big mistake, but it cost us precious seconds. I know what I did wrong. I identified the mistake. Here's what I'm going to do to fix it so it'll never happen again. And the team leader would point to the next guy, and he would do the same thing. Notice the complete difference in tone, strategy, outlook, and execution between these two teams. The team that blamed everybody for everything obviously couldn't do anything as an organized unit, because to be a member of an organized, efficient, deadly unit, you each have to trust each other with your lives. And you can't do that if you're constantly blaming other people in your team, in your life, for things that are wrong with you. But the team that took ownership, where the team leader, the platoon leader, would literally go to his superiors and say, yes, sir, we blew that up because one of my men didn't have his rifle scoped out correctly. It's my fault, sir. I take responsibility. I'll make sure it never happens again. I'm like, whoa, okay. This is the attitude of somebody I can trust, is what the superior officer is thinking. This is the attitude of somebody who's not going to screw around. He identified the mistake. He's going to rectify it. I don't have to worry about this ever again. He's taken ownership of himself. And if he does it again, I'm going to chew him out and make sure that he gets punished or cashiered or whatever needs to happen to him. But the point is that that officer was on record as saying, I screwed up. I made a mistake. This is what I did. Here's how I'm going to fix it. Now I'm going to go fix it. End of story. End of discussion. That is how you build effective relationships. That is how you take control of your destiny. That is how you become the man you're supposed to be. By accepting everything that is wrong in your life is your fault. Now you can go fix it. Now, in case you're wondering who Jocko Willink is, you got to go look up this guy's biography. It's astonishing. He was the commanding officer of Task Unit Bruiser, part of SEAL Team 10. And as commanding officer of Task Unit Bruiser, he oversaw what became the most highly decorated unit in all of Gulf War II. All of it. The most highly decorated SEAL team unit in all of Gulf War II. They operated in particularly the hottest and worst of the action in Ramadi, and were known at the time, I believe, for having some very serious, very famous guys on their squad. Let me go look up his bio. But Jocko is a legend in the teams, and he was a lieutenant commander in Task Unit Bruiser, as I said, and he was part of SEAL Team 3, and he fought against Iraqi insurgents in Ramadi, won the Silver Star, or was honored with the Silver Star and the Bronze Star, and achieved the rank of lieutenant commander over the course of a 20-year military service career, which is astonishing. He had under his command at the time Mark Allen Lee, Michael Mansour, Johnny Kim, Kevin Latch, I think that's how you pronounce his name, Kevin Latch, and Chris Kyle. You may recognize the name Chris Kyle as the name of the American sniper, the most prolific and skilled sniper in American history. Chris Kyle, in his own book, stated that he doesn't, he's dead now, unfortunately. He was shot by a Marine suffering from PTSD at a gun range, actually, of all things. But Chris Kyle himself would state that he was not nearly as good as Carlos Hathcock, but you know, that is what it is. The point is, Jocko's philosophy is exactly what people need, exactly what broken and lost and struggling people need in order to understand how to fix themselves, because that's how you fix yourself. And it brings to mind, as I said, that poem by Tecumseh. It is a beautiful poem, and it is, quote, the last paragraph, or not poem, but letter, is quoted in full in a great movie called Act of Valor, which stars real Navy SEALs, real active duty Navy SEALs, doing the things that they do in combat scenarios. And what Tecumseh said was as follows. So live your life that the fear of death can never enter your heart. Trouble no one about their religion. Respect others and their view, and demand that they respect yours. Love your life. Perfect your life. Beautify all things in your life. Seek to make your life long and its purpose in the service of your people. Prepare a noble death song for the day when you go over the great divide. Always give a word or a sign of salute when meeting or passing a friend, even a stranger, when in a lonely place. Show respect to all people and grovel to none. When you arise in the morning, give thanks for the food and for the joy of living. If you see no reason for giving thanks, the fault lies only in yourself. Abuse no one and no thing, for abuse turns the wise ones to fools and robs the spirit of its vision. When it comes your time to die, be not like those whose hearts are filled with the fear of death, so that when their time comes, they weep and pray for a little more time to live their lives over again in a different way. Sing your death song and die like a hero going home. Those are powerful words by a great man. And if you don't know who Tecumseh was, go look him up on the Kings and Generals channel. I mean, I, I, I don't like propping up, giving props to Kings and Generals, not because their content is bad. Their content is absolutely incredible. But because they are supporters of the Black Looming Menace movement, and I have no interest in sending subscribers their way, but genuinely, I mean, you know, as much as it irritates me to say it, go look up their videos. It's a 2 or 3 part series on Tecumseh. It's excellent. The animation is superb. The narration by their longtime narrator, who's done hundreds of videos for these guys, is astonishing. And the historiography as told in the video is excellent. So as much as it annoys me to send people their way, go check it out. It's worth it. Now, this issue of that Tecumseh raised, he raises a number of points in that passage, which any masculine man needs to analyze and take to heart. If you are, for instance, as building on what I said earlier about being responsible for yourself, if you are, for instance, not in the job that you want to be in, okay, that's on you. Figure out how to move. And you're going to come up with all sorts of excuses. You know, oh, I'm here on a work visa. I can't move. I can't do this. I can't do that. I don't have the skills. I don't have the training. No, that's not how it works. Just shut up and do it. Just shut up and find a way to do it. Because the moment you admit to yourself, I'm not where I want to be, and it's my fault, and then that's the key, and it's my fault. Those four words, it's my fault. Those four words, and it is, well, five, and it is my fault, okay? I'm not where I want to be, and it is my fault. Once you admit that to yourself, you immediately are in the position to say to yourself, okay, I screwed up. I messed up. Now how do I fix it? Because that's how adults respond to situations. They don't say to themselves, well, you know, it's my fault, but I don't want to do anything about it. I'm content with where I am. Okay, well, or, yeah, it's my fault, but I really feel like blaming someone else. No, that's not how an adult responds to a situation. The SEAL teams, going back to those SEAL teams, that the SEAL team that won everything and the SEAL team that lost everything, every single obstacle course, every single race. The SEAL team that won everything was composed of adults led by adults. The SEAL team that lost everything was composed of children led by children. The children were looking for a parent to pat them on the head and say, well done, you're doing well, what's important is you try, you really tried, you really, really did your best. Okay. That's not good enough. Especially when we're talking in the context of people trained to rain death and destruction and lethal violence down upon those who are sworn enemies of the United States of America. Saying it's someone else's responsibility, or saying that I did my best or tried to do my best, that's just not going to cut it. That's not good enough. It's not about trying to do your best. It's about doing. It's not about trying. And that, you know, do or do not. There is no try. From Star Wars, of course, from specifically Empire Strikes Back, back when the Star Wars movies were actually good, instead of the awful, horrible crap that they are now, thanks to the Devil Mouse, the never to be sufficiently cursed Devil Mouse. If you are in a situation that you don't like, the moment you accept that it's on you, it's your fault, it's your problem, you can get yourself out of it. You just have to then figure out how to do it and then execute. But the moment you start by saying, it's in my control, then a whole world of opportunities opens up to you. And let me be clear, I'm speaking from extremely painful personal experience here. I lived and worked in the United States for 12 years. I wouldn't say I was successful, but I had achieved some level of considerable comfort and stability, at least I thought it was stability, until it was taken from me in the USA. I worked in a big bank, I worked in actually two big banks while I was there and a consulting firm. And I was there on a work visa, which meant that my ability to move around was very limited because of the way that the unique way that the H-1B system works. And as far as I'm concerned, that means that the entire thing needs to be scrapped and you need to get rid of work visas in the USA completely and start with something less stupid. But, you know, that's an argument for another podcast. I couldn't move around, I thought, because I wasn't free to move around. And then I created chains for myself by tying myself to a martial arts school, which I truly loved and still love. The fact that I am away from my friends and unable to practice that martial art of Krav Maga is a wound in my soul that has never healed and probably never will. It is the worst part by far of being away from the USA. I don't really care about any of the rest of it. The work is like, you know, it's just the work. The apartment, yeah, okay, it was nice. My stuff, yeah, I mean, I really miss my whiskey collection, my books, and having my own kitchen, arranged the way I like it. But I can deal with that. Not being around the people that I truly love and respect, not being able to spar with my friends, not being able to learn honor, dignity, responsibility, and mastery from people that I genuinely admire. That is hard. That is a burden that has never, I mean, in the 2 and a bit years that I've been away, it's never diminished. It's just gotten worse over time. But I chose to be at that school, and I chose to study there for 5 years. And it's the only reason, really, why I stayed in that area, why I stayed in the U.S. If I hadn't found that school, I'd probably been like, yeah, you know, I'd be happy to leave eventually. I love the USA, I love America, but there was nothing tying me to it until I found my second family there. And I should have accepted responsibility for my own lack of stability, my own vulnerability, but I didn't. I was sort of like, I kind of trusted in the system. I figured that if I put the responsibility upon my company to get me through the work permit process and get my green card going, then I would be okay. And I was catastrophically and totally wrong. When Donald Trump was elected, or as we call him around here, his most illustrious, august, benevolent, and legendary, his most illustrious, noble, august, benevolent, and legendary celestial majesty, the God Emperor of Mankind, Donaldus Triumphus Magnus Astra, the first of his name, the Lion of Midnight, may the Lord bless him and preserve him, that Donald Trump, when he was elected as president, he made the usage of the H-1B considerably harder over the next 2 years, to the point where a number of particularly big banks simply stopped accepting H-1B applications, and the ability of H-1s to move between companies pretty much dried up. It freed up a little bit more over time, but from my understanding today, it's still really hard to move from company to company if you're an H-1. And I kind of trusted in the system. And I shouldn't have. I should never have allowed that vulnerability to grow to the point where I could get my entire world kicked out from under me. But I did, and it's my fault. So now that I have acknowledged it's my fault, okay, now I can do something about it. What is that something? Well, go to another country where the systems aren't as annoying in order to get permanent residency and citizenship. Apply for skilled residency in another country. Get married, if that's what you want to do. You know, if you're in my situation, get married and have a kid somewhere. There are ways to overcome that issue. It can be done. Buy your way into citizenship if that's what you can afford and that's what you can do. I'm not saying these are good things. I mean, there are problems with every single one of them. You know, I am very much a nationalist, which means I believe in the idea of a nation as defined by a people, not by a passport. That's why, as far as I'm concerned, you know, my passport says that I am part of this country. I'm really not. I've got absolutely nothing in common with them other than the fact that I was born there. And, you know, that's not nearly enough to make me a part of that nation. And they feel pretty much the same way about me. You know, the people of that nation, as far as I can tell, are like, well, you don't look or talk or act or sound or behave like us, so what are you doing here? I'm like, okay, screw you. And that's been the case ever since I had to go back. If you take a look at another aspect of my life, I actually used to be quite fat. And most people who have never met me or seen me in person won't know this. But I wasn't always someone who could squat at peak strength, 315, or actually, my heaviest squat was 365 pounds. My heaviest deadlift was 465 pounds, but that was with probably not great form. So I'm going to count it as like 460 pounds was my heaviest deadlift. My heaviest bench press was 235 pounds. Was it 240? No, 200. I'm pretty sure it's 235. I'm not going to exaggerate my numbers. Those are numbers that most people of my ethnic background cannot lift and never will lift. And while there are plenty of guys who are my size and weight who can lift like twice what I can lift, now, I'm not joking about that. I mean, there are guys who weigh about 85 kilos, which is roughly what I weigh right now, who can easily deadlift 800 pounds and easily squat 600 pounds and easily bench 350 pounds. If you go look up the IPF, the International Powerlifting Federation's world records for each weight class, you're going to find that guys in those ranges significantly outlift me. So I'm not a good powerlifter by any means, and my body is paying a terrible price for some instances of bad form where I really screwed myself up. But the point is, I took responsibility for the fact that my physique and my strength level was not where I wanted it to be. Back in 2011, I looked around, and like actually late 2010, I looked around at where I was, and I realized, you know what, I'm fat, I'm lazy, I'm eating everything that I'm told I should eat. I'm going to the gym five times a week, but I have no motivation to go to the gym. I hate going there. I just, you know, I faff around. I don't have a program. I don't have a strategy. And I don't seem to be particularly strong. I seem to be pretty fat, actually. I seem to not make any progress. I don't look good in my clothes. So I said to myself, you know what? You need to make a change. You have to admit it's your fault that you're not exactly where you want to be. And I said, yeah, it is my fault. It is my fault that I'm not the level of strength that I want to be at. That's what led me to the Strong Lifts program, Mehdi Hadim's 5x5 Strong Lifts program, which is one of several starting or beginning lifting programs for absolute novices. And it's the one that I recommend. There are others out there like Mark Ripito's Starting Strength, which emphasizes a 3x5 approach. So basically five sets of three reps. Mehdi's Strong Lift program recommends five sets of five reps. So, and you alternate exercises between basically just two workouts. You do, on day one, you do squat, bench, and barbell rows. On day two, you do squat, deadlift, and overhead press, and so on. And that's it. That's, I mean, I could get the exact... I could get the exact workouts wrong. Yeah, I apologize for that. It's a bit late, and this podcast is later than usual for reasons that are entirely out of my control. But basically, Mehdi's approach is, the point is, it's a very structured approach, and it is strength engineering. It is literally taking the time-tested, time-honed principles of engineering, of being able to repeat results time and time and time and time and time again across a wide range of scenarios to achieve similar outcomes every single time. That's what makes powerlifting strength engineering. The science is not what most people think it is, but engineering is very straightforward. You take principles of science, ideas from science, and you apply them in the real world. And it only works if you can replicate the results time and time again. With powerlifting, you can take people from all sorts of genetic backgrounds, all sorts of body compositions, all sorts of heights and weights and body types, all sorts of weight classes, and you can give them the exact same program. No variation whatsoever. And you can tailor it in the sense that each individual will squat a different way, or each individual will deadlift somewhat differently. You can teach them the basic squat and deadlift cues and the basic bench cues, and you can then adjust that for their particular physiques. So for instance, in my case, I have quite a bad lower back, and that's partly genetic. I get that from my granddad. May he rest in peace, but he did pass down a very dodgy, dicey lower back to his male descendants, actually pretty much all of his descendants. And the result is that I have somewhat flat arches and a very dodgy lower back, particularly in my lumbar vertebrae, all of which, by the way, are bulging out right now. Every single one is bulging. And one in particular is like just touching the nerve bundle that runs along the right side of my spine. I can feel it every time I do squats. And I have to be really, really careful not to let the disc herniate outwards and just pinch that bundle between the bone and the disc. Because when that happens, your entire lower body just shuts down. And it's like your back locks up and you can't move. You can barely breathe. It's so painful. It's like, it's the worst injury you can imagine, short of limb amputation, basically. So I adjust my squat form and I adjust my deadlift form to deal with these things. And that's the point, is even though I am doing the exact same program, I'm making small adjustments, but I get the same results. I get the same kinds of results. And it all comes from taking ownership, from saying to yourself, this is my fault. I screwed up. I messed up. That's the answer to life. That's the answer to making sense of everything that's gone wrong. I'll give you another example. If you're in a bad relationship with a woman, I mean, many of us have had this unfortunate reality happen to us where you're dealing with a woman who's just completely batshit insane. And, or, you know, like she's really emotional. She's been damaged by trauma in her past. She's had a lot of hardship in her life, and she hides it well, but eventually it all comes out and she tries to mold you into what you want to be, into what she wants you to be, not what you want to be. And you say to her, no, hang on, honey, that's not going to work. I'm not going to do that. And you're dealing with like complete screaming fits and meltdowns, just like complete and utter total loss of self-control. If you stay in that relationship, that's your fault. Okay? It's her fault for melting down. Yes. She's going to blame it on you. And to some extent, yes, you are actually responsible for that. Because as men, it is our duty, our responsibility to take care of and love and nurture our women. That is true. But you cannot really prevent a woman from going apeshit. You can only create the conditions so that she doesn't go apeshit. If you fail to create those conditions, yes, you are at fault. But she is ultimately at fault for going apeshit in the first place, because at some level, there is no excuse for that sort of complete loss of control. And unfortunately, too many women these days do that. And they do it as a way to test men. And they're always going to do it, but you know, that's the reality of women. Women are designed to test men. They are designed, as the Bible says, if you look at the New Living Translation in Genesis chapter 4, verse 16, you will see it says very clearly in the New Living Translation, which is the best of the translations of this particular verse, she will desire to dominate her husband, and you will desire to dominate your husband, basically. But he will ultimately control you. He will ultimately push back against you. I'm mischaracterizing the words horribly, but you get my point. If you remain in that relationship, that's on you, and you've got to figure out a way to live with it. If you get out of that relationship, and you deal, you're going to have to find a way to deal with all the psychological damage that comes from being in a relationship like that. That's on you too. You have to accept it was your fault for being there in the first place. You were there. It was your fault that you stayed there. Okay. Now you've accepted responsibility. What are you going to do about it? Well, go see a therapist. Go talk to a friend. If you're going to talk to a therapist, by the way, go to a Christian counselor. Don't go to a secular counselor. I have mostly contempt for the so-called science of psychology, and I'm not alone in this aspect. I will readily admit that therapy does good things for people, up to a point. But I do not believe that if you're going to make somebody do therapy and avoid pointing him towards God and Jesus Christ, I don't believe you're going to really get anywhere. In the end, I think you're going to be stuck with an endless cycle of being dependent on therapy to fix your problems. You get more problems, you go to therapy again, you fix those problems, you pick up more problems. It's an endless cycle, and it doesn't, from what I've seen of people who are addicted to therapy, it does not go well for them. So, anyway, worth considering. Imagine if you're in a relationship with a woman who is a serial cheater, or is a woman who just may not actually physically cheat on you, but is constantly texting and talking to other guys, is constantly making it clear that she's looking out for the best possible option that she can get. She's basically monkey branching, as the red pill term goes. She's monkey branching to see which guy she can land on, who will give her the most fancy pants and lollipops. And this is a common problem with women, particularly women who did not have strong fathers or didn't even have a father at all. They don't know how to settle for a decent man now so that they will have what they want in the future. They instead try to find the guy who has everything now, while not realizing that the guy who has everything now is usually one of two types of guys. Either he doesn't want to share everything he has now with a woman, and he's quite content to play the field, and he's never going to get serious, or he's the kind of guy who is looking at women who are much younger than the kind of woman in question. The kind of woman I'm describing here is typically in her mid to late 30s, or it can start as soon as the early 30s, where the monkey branching really goes into overdrive, because women smash headfirst into a very sickening reality if they're not married by the age of 30, and it happens all the time. If you go to Eastern Europe, it's particularly prevalent there, where the women just start freaking out and they're like, holy shit, I'm 30 years old, I'm not married, all my friends are married, they have kids, my family's putting pressure on me to get married, I'm running out of time, I want to bear children, what am I going to do, and they come unglued. They really do. They really become unhinged. I've seen it too many times to count. It's quite ugly when it happens. But all of that being said, what is the point, ultimately, of such extreme ownership? The point is that with this ownership comes freedom. You now own yourself. By pushing onto yourself the burden of responsibility, you now own the outcomes as well. There's a wonderful interplay in Robert A. Heinlein's Starship Troopers, the greatest military science fiction novel ever written. It's actually a civics lesson rather than a novel, contained in about 268 pages. I have read it. I've lost count of how many times I've read it. I read it at least once every 3 months, thereabouts, to keep the novel fresh in my mind. There is a magnificent exchange towards the latter third, the last third of the book, in which Major Henry Reed, Major Reed teaches a course called History and Moral Philosophy. And he asks the novel's protagonist, Johnny Rico, what is the converse of authority? He had picked one that I could answer. Responsibility, sir. Applause for both practical reasons and for mathematically verifiable moral reasons. Authority must always be equal to responsibility, else a balancing takes place as surely as current flows between two points of unequal potential. To behave with irresponsible authority is to invite disaster. To hold a man responsible for anything that he does not control is blind idiocy. I'm mangling the quote a bit, but you get the idea. The quote itself is astonishingly powerful because it points the way to true freedom. You have just given yourself responsibility to take charge of your life by saying, it's my fault, I'm not where I want to be. Okay, it's your responsibility, go fix it. That's how an adult responds to things. You are responsible for your life, go fix it. Go fix what's wrong. Okay, who's going to give me the authority? Oh, wait, there is no one to give me authority. I have to be my own authority. I have to take authority. I have to take charge. I am responsible for this mistake. But that means I have the authority to fix it. Authority and responsibility are now equal, which means you now have the freedom to act as is necessary to do what you have to do to fix your problem within the realms of your power. Whatever you are capable of doing, whatever you have available to you, you can now use all the tools at your disposal because you have given yourself the right to do it. What happens when you start exercising this right? Become free. Why? There's another quote from my blog, which longtime readers have known me to use for many, many instances. And it's not actually my quote. This is from William S. Lind's book, Victoria. It's a novel about fourth generation warfare. Extremely highly recommended. Brilliant book. Everybody who wants to understand what's going to happen in the coming months and years as the West falls apart needs to read that book. It's phenomenal. A bit hard to read at times, but phenomenal. In that book, William S. Lind, whose ideas of fourth generation warfare, maybe I'll get into in another podcast, I don't know, they're controversial. At least one of my longtime readers, a man who I hold in considerable esteem, Lieutenant Colonel Tom Kratman, U.S. Army retired, takes issue with the ideas behind 4GW and maneuver warfare and decision cycle theory, which all come from Colonel John Boyd of the Air Force and William S. Lind, civilian military historian and strategist. And he argues that, you know what, there's a lot more to it than just these factors that Bill Lind and John Boyd came up with. It's much, much more than that. He has his own acronym called MOSMOS, which I can't for the life of me remember what it stands for, but I'm sure he'll tell me at one point or another in the comments. But in that book, William S. Lind lays out a one line that explains freedom perfectly. Freedom is not the right to do whatever you want. The freedom is not the right to live as you please. Freedom is instead the substitution of internally imposed discipline for discipline imposed from without. That's it. That's what freedom is. The moment you accept your responsibility for your own screw-ups, the moment that you accept that you have the authority to fix those screw-ups, you now have everything you need to impose upon yourself the discipline to be free. And that is the thought that I want you to take away. Freedom is all about accepting responsibility for yourself. It doesn't matter if your ancestors were enslaved and brought to the United States. You weren't. You are free. You have the right to live your life as you please in the greatest country in the world. So stop with this bullshit about how you are continually oppressed. You're not oppressed. You want oppression? Go to India. Go to Africa. Go to the Middle East. See true oppression to its face. If you do not have a great job or a great college education or a great career, build one for yourself. You don't need to go to college anymore. College is basically a waste of time. It's an indoctrination camp, a factory for producing worker drones. You don't need to go there. You don't need to work for a big corporation anymore. You can start your own business. You can build your own platform. You can do whatever it is you want because the tools are out there. The ideas are out there. You don't need to do these things. You don't need to live up to other people's expectations. You only need to live up to your own. Final thought before I wrap up. I know a lot of this might sound as though I have all the answers. I don't. Look, listen, anyone listening to this, you need to understand I am one of the biggest screw-ups you'll ever come across. I have failed so comprehensively in so many different areas of life, it's not even funny. No one on this planet should be looking up to me as a paragon of excellence or virtue because I am not one. I am a profound failure and a disappointment in so many ways, it's not even funny. But I accept that. I accept my screw-ups, my failures, my problems. And I accept that I am responsible for fixing them. Most of all, I mean, as much as I've disappointed my father and my parents, you know, it's not their fault. It's my fault. They were the most wonderful parents. They are the most wonderful parents a child could hope for. I mean, yeah, they made mistakes, but what parents don't? Most of all, I think what I regret most deeply is disappointing God, because I am a colossal disappointment to Him. And it's one that's a fact that I'm going to be paying for the rest of my life. But the fact is, I can deal with that because I know where I have to fix things. And I can either choose to fix them or not. And the same choice applies to all of you. So with that, let me wrap up. It is getting very close to the 1 hour mark, and I don't like to run over on these things. I hope you found this rant useful in some regard. This is all about taking control of your life, taking control of your destiny, understanding the root of your problems and figuring out where to tackle these problems and how to approach them. So, by all means, stop by, leave a comment here on the podcast, leave a comment at the blog. If you want to support my work, click on the links for the products and the books that I mentioned in the podcast itself. Buy a few of them because they're really good. I don't recommend bad books to people, okay? If it's a book recommendation from me, you can be sure it's a damn good one. And while you're at it, stop by my friend Adam Piggott's podcast, Pushing Rubber Downhill, and be sure to check him out because he's a lot of fun to listen to. And he's got a much better accent than me because, of course, he's an Aussie. And stop by superbshaving.com. Check out some of the products that I have put up there. I will have a very exciting announcement to give you next week, I hope. And whenever that comes around, it'll be about a course that that will be sold in conjunction with a good friend of mine. And I think people will get a lot of value out of it. Anyway, this has been Didactic Mind, episode 42, Life, the Universe, and Everything. I am Didact, and I will see you on the next one.